We don't know how to set up an intelligence which is very advanced but not yet super intelligent, so that when it crosses the line and becomes super intelligence, it has our best interests at heart, and always has our best interests at heart. I frankly don't think it's possible.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. I'm here today with one of my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft, and we're delighted to be joined by Callum Chase. So, Callum, you've got a background in philosophy at Oxford, and you've also been in business and marketing and so on, but I mostly know you as the guy who's been waving the flag about AI for some time now. From your books and from think tanks we've been in together, you wrote a book called Surviving AI and the Economic Singularity, and also Pandora's Brain. Tell us, you know, AI's taken off in the last 3 months. We know it's been around for years, but it's now been released into the public domain. Are you horrified?
So, Gary, thanks very much. It's nice to be with you guys. And that was a very kind and accurate summary. And you're right. I've been talking about the enormous importance of AI for as loudly as I can in public for over a decade. I've been thinking about it for a lot longer than that. And you're right, it's kind of coming to the public attention now, thanks to ChatGPT, which was launched last November, and GPT-4, which launched on the 14th of March. This is actually the result of the second big bang in AI, which happened in 2017, when some researchers at Google unveiled a new AI technology called transformers. Mm-hmm. And the neat thing about transformers is they don't need to be trained by humans. Most of their training takes place, I want to say automatically, they do it themselves. They play peekaboo with themselves. What they do is they have access to an absolutely enormous amount of text, most of the internet, and they cover up a word, or a token actually, which is a roughly speaking 3/4 of a word, and they have a guess from the context what that word should be. If they get it right, then they give themselves a pat on the back. If they get it wrong, then they adjust the model slightly. And they do this billions of times. Mm. And as a result of that, they get really, really good at predicting the next word in a sequence of words. And curiously, something I hadn't realized is that that's pretty much what we do. When I am talking, and I'm pretty sure this is true of everybody else as well, I have no idea what the fifth next word I'm going to say is. The words just sort of come tumbling out in a sequence which is roughly designed to meet a fairly fuzzy goal I've got about what I'm trying to say.
Callum, I was trying to explain this to my kids last week, that the way we communicate, the way we form sentences, yes, is probably loosely structured on A, our vocabulary, but B, our grammar, you know, an understanding of what makes sense to say next. But at the essentially, we are doing it as we go, right? And we are learning on almost a probability basis, what's the next best word to put next in what we're saying?
Exactly. And that's what these machines do. And they can predict the next word in the most blindingly obvious way, or you can tweak them to provide some more varied output. And that's known as the having a different temperature. There's a lot of difference between their intelligence and ours, a huge amount of difference. But in that respect, they do something similar.
I mean, you said there was the possibility, this is like 10 years ago when we first met, that the first machine with human-level cognition was going to be created within the next few decades. Have you revised your timeline?
Like most people in the AI community and people outside the AI community, like myself looking in, my timelines have shortened. So I was, I suppose, relatively pessimistic. I had fairly long timelines. I used to think that it'd probably be about 25 years before we had machines which can do pretty much everything that we can do for money, and therefore we'd have technological unemployment and what I call the economic singularity. Mm. And then another 25 years beyond that until we had machines which are smarter than us in every single way. And so then we'd have superintelligence, and that's the most important event ever in human history. Now, I think that could all happen in 25 years. And Jeff Hinton, very famously, the godfather of deep learning, is saying something similar. So it's all go.
Are you in the camp of we should slow it down, or are you full steam ahead?
It's really complicated. So I admire and respect the people behind the Future of Life open letter calling for a 6-month moratorium. I think fundamentally the attempt to stop the development of advanced AI is doomed. I think, and this surprised me, that they could actually get a moratorium active in the US, which is where almost all of these models are developed, and in China, where, in fact, the government has already said to its big tech companies and it's time to slow down because they don't like out of... Well, Europe doesn't matter because they're not being made here. I mean, the EU obviously is an important regulatory authority. The rest of the world has to pay attention. But there's no big tech here. There's no none of these large language models being invented here.
Britain is open for business.
Britain is hardly open for business. Britain has decided to close for business and decided to run itself by a bunch of charlatans and crooks. So I think Britain's becoming an increasingly irrelevant.
Italy put a brake on the use of AI tools. Then Europe, they didn't need to go further because Europe has put a kind of European brake on that came out last week. But what about Britain being renegade? Do you think we could be the place where we say, come and do your development here and there'll be no brakes on?
No, I think there's zero chance of that. Italy did put a brake on and pretty much nobody took any notice. OpenAI tweaked a few things and Italy has now said, okay, yes, you're welcome back. Europe didn't put a brake on advanced AI. It said it's going to regulate it and it's going to spend some time thinking about it, which is, you know, that's a worthwhile effort. Britain going against the rest of the West and developing advanced AI when everybody else has decided not to. I mean, in some ways, Britain doesn't seem to mind being a pariah country. As I say, it's run by some crooks and charlatans at the moment and fairly shameless about that. But no, I absolutely do not see Britain being the place where advanced AI is developed if everybody else has decided to stop. But Russia and North Korea and various mafia organizations and various very rich billionaires, they're the places where it would carry on regardless of whatever everybody else decided to do. Now, right now, they wouldn't be able to do much because they don't have the talent, they don't have the money, and it's incredibly expensive. But that will change. In 10 years' time, the amount of compute it takes, the amount of data it takes will be much, much less, and it will be within the power of a state like Russia or Iran or North Korea to carry on developing these things. And so it will happen. So reluctantly, I have to say, I don't support the call for pause. I think it makes absolute sense. You know, if you're doing something which could lead to the extinction of the human race, you ought to take very seriously the possibility of stopping. And there's even an argument, as somebody said, a chap called Eliezer Yudkowsky said, if you know that there's a madman around who's going to kill your children, that's not really a good reason to kill your children first. However, there are enormous upsides from AI, and to forego the opportunity of those upsides because of the danger, if you can't actually stop the danger anyway, that seems tragic. So reluctantly, I come to the conclusion that we shouldn't pause.
We're talking with Callum Chase. Callum is best-selling author and AI expert and specializes in the future of AI and its impacts on all of us, our societies and our economies. He's written 4 books on AI, 2 of them were novels and 2 are nonfiction. Surviving AI, The Economic Singularity, Pandora's Oracle, and Pandora's Brain. I'm curious about the economic singularity you talk about. And you flagged, you know, technological unemployment a long time ago. What's your view today?
Pretty much still the same. That one day, unless AIs stop getting smarter, they will be good enough to do everything that we can do for money, or pretty much everything that we can do for money, cheaper and better and faster than we can. And when that day comes, and I think it will happen quite suddenly, actually, I think it'll be a phase change, like when you boil water, it goes from the water phase to the steam phase very quickly after injecting a lot of energy. When that happens, I think we're going to need a very different type of economy. There are some extremely good possible outcomes. The idea that humans always have to be wage slaves is rather depressing. it's fine for people like you and me because we enjoy our jobs, but most people do their jobs just to put food on the table. It's not a source of meaning or great joy to them. And if we can liberate most people from that, then hooray. But it will require a different type of economy, and we haven't even begun to think about what that looks like yet. I mean, I have in the economic singularity.
Yes.
Got part of the way there, but there's a lot more work to be done, and we should be thinking about it. We should be thinking about it now.
You talk about in that book how to be happy in a jobless future. How can we be happy in a jobless future? Can we be?
Well, yeah, it would be great because it would mean people would be on holiday the whole time, and who doesn't like being on holiday? People often worry that without jobs, we'd have no meaning in our lives. But as I said before, I don't think that for most people, jobs are a source of meaning. Our meaning comes from our friends, our family, our hobbies, our intellectual lives, our sporting teams that we follow, you know, whatever we do for fun. And in a world where humans didn't have to do jobs to have enough to eat and have enough clothes and shelter and so on, we could all do whatever we want to do. Now, a lucky minority of people are in that position already, the very rich, the retired, children, actually, and aristocrats. And guess what? Aristocrats and children and well-off retired people do not have a lack of meaning in their lives. You know, they're not all going around. You don't see children saying, give me a job. Give me a job. I'm bored. You don't hear that from comfortably off retired people or aristocrats either. So I look forward to a world where everybody gets to do what they want to do all the time. I think we'll have a second renaissance. I think we'll have a much better world. If we crack the economic question, what does that economy look like? Big question.
It's got to be an economy that's more fair, though. Because if there's one thing that I know for certain, that people with a lot of resources, wealthy aristocrats, and also billionaires want more than anything else, security. And how much are they prepared to give up resources in exchange for security and peace? And what's to stop us tipping into revolution if the people who do not have as much opportunity or do not have as many resources decide that it's going to become a free-for-all and you know, it's worth fighting for?
You're absolutely right. One of the often touted solutions to this problem is universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And the word in the middle, basic, is a telltale giveaway that this is not the answer. We have to do much better than giving everybody a basic income, because if that's all we do, then the great majority of people are going to be out with the pitchforks attacking wealthy people like you, Garrick. You're going to have to, you know, find yourself a private island and surround it with AIs of formidable defensive capabilities. And that's just a miserable outcome for everybody. So yeah, we need to find a way to have this fully automated world be a world of luxury for everybody. I like to call it fully automated luxury capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Callum, do you think we will go there though? So for example, new jobs that are emerging at the moment are things like prompt engineers, right? It is a skill to learn how to prompt GPT and other generative AI tools to give you a better result. And we're just figuring that out now, right? So as before, as with every major technological advance, are we not just going to invent more jobs and demand more of the people who are around to do them?
So you're absolutely right. We've had automation for a very long time, since the 1500s, before Aristotle actually mentioned the possibility of having robots do all people's jobs. And it's going to continue that way for quite a while. We're going to have automation and there are going to be new jobs created. And of course, we can't predict what those new jobs will be. But the fundamental question is, will there come a time when machines are able to do pretty much everything that we can do for money, cheaper and better and faster than us? And I think the answer to that question is clearly yes, unless for some reason AI stop improving. And I see no reason why that would happen. Even if we have the moratorium on the development of the particular types of advanced AIs that's being called for now, other types of AI will still be developed. And so I'm pretty sure we will get to the point where machines can do everything cheaper and better, faster than us. And at that point, there won't be jobs for humans. There'll be lots of work for us to do because we will do things, we'll do projects, we'll pursue hobbies and build buildings quite possibly, even though it's wildly uneconomic. We'll do it for fun. We'll do it because we like doing it. We'll do it for creative expression. but we won't be able to make a living doing it because there's a robot that will do it cheaper. And at that point, there won't be any new jobs created except for other robots. There'll be new jobs, but they won't be filled by humans. So that's the point at which we need this new type of economy. But until that point, you're quite right. There will be automation chucking people out of a job, and those people will go on and get a better job. And we ought to get a lot better at making that transition easy, because it's always been quite bumpy. And for some people, it's extremely painful, and it kills some people. So we need to get much better at that, dealing with the churn, because the churn is going to accelerate. The automation process is going to accelerate. But you're quite right. For some years, and as I say, I used to think it was 25 years or more. Now I think maybe it's a dozen years. And that could be out by, you know, a decade or 2 decades, who knows? But this is coming. This stuff is coming. And I think it's going to be sudden. When we get to the point where the machines, oh, this latest version, GPT-23 or whatever it is, it can now do everything that a human can do for money. And suddenly, there's no jobs for humans anymore.
I'm encouraging people to read your book, the one about 2045, called Stories from 2045, because you were attempting to create some scenarios around what the world might look like in 2045. Do you want to paint some of those pictures for our listeners?
Yeah, so this was a great book. I forget exactly how many stories, maybe 40 or 50 stories. They were written by members of a think tank that I set up, which occupies itself with thinking about how this new economic system could work, and also raising awareness of the fact that this is probably happening. And it was a great book because it was quite ambitious. We have positive stories at one end of the book and negative stories at the other end. And at the positive end, it's got a green cover with a nice picture of robots and people working together. And at the negative end, there's a red cover with a human disappearing down a trapdoor sprung by a robot. And you turn the book over. So one half is upside down from the other half. And my printers said, you can't do that. And the interesting thing about it was that I had to really push the contributors to contribute positive stories, because it's so much easier to write dystopia. I guess that's partly because that's what Hollywood mostly provides us with. And so we've got those stories running around in our head. But also, any good story needs jeopardy, and jeopardy often leads to thoughts about dystopia. But the rough idea was, if things go badly, then we will have a world in which most people are beginning to starve, or they're subsisting on the crumbs thrown to them by the ultra-rich. And the ultra-rich are defending themselves on private islands. And it's terrible, and it just gets worse. So that's the dystopic possibility. The positive possibility, and by the way, I hate the word utopia. Don't hate the word utopia, but utopia is boring because nothing happens. No, there's no change. There's no fun. There's no surprises, and also completely impractical. So I really like Kevin Kelly's idea of protopia. And a protopia is a world where everything is really good, and it just keeps getting better and better. So the green end of the book is protopia stories, in which we have succeeded in devising a world where resources are made available to everybody, not necessarily completely equally, but abundant resources so that everybody has a really great life. Personally, I think the way that can happen is we're probably going to have a two-speed economy. There's an economy in which everything is almost free, and this is the key. We need this economy of abundance in which the resources you need for a very good standard of living are almost free. All of the food you might want, all the clothing, housing, the housing stock keeps getting upgraded and renewed by all these formidably efficient robotic systems. All that stuff is virtually free, and therefore you don't have to tax rich people very much to make it happen. Then there's this other economy, which is about luxuries and things that you really don't need but are quite fun. So original Vermeer paintings, Aston Martins, the house with the best position on a white sandy beach with palm trees and so on. And people can get rich, and it's a capitalist economy, and you tax that economy to provide the fairly modest amounts of money you need to keep the other broad economy, which all of us except for you, Garrick, are going to be active in, you know, to keep that going.
I'm trying to figure out my own future here, Colin, with you. But back to dystopia, I get it. And that makes sense because resources are becoming more freely available and easier to achieve. But why would those who currently make a lot of money and enrich themselves through providing resources right now, why would they give that up in some respects and allow this large sort of underclass, if you like, of most people to move into a place of abundance? What would be the point of that?
I think there's three reasons. The first reason is basic survival. So the super rich could isolate themselves in some remote islands and surround those islands with, you know, incredible defensive capabilities and wait while the remaining 7.99 billion of us all just starve to death or shoot each other.
Yeah.
It'd be a horrific thing for them to go through, but they could do that probably. But there's a pretty decent chance it wouldn't work. It's a pretty decent chance that some of the 7.9 billion would get hold of very sophisticated airplanes and bomb them to bits. You know, it's a very risky strategy.
Yeah.
But a more important reason than that is I actually don't think, and I know this is incredibly countercultural and a bizarre thing to say, I don't think the very rich are bad people. I think they're just more successful and generally more lucky. I mean, they're perhaps a bit smarter and more hardworking than the rest of us. I've worked for some very rich people and they're not monsters. I mean, some of them are, but they're not all monsters. And some of them, quite a lot of them actually, are people of very much goodwill. Again, this is probably very controversial, but it seems pretty obvious to me that Bill Gates wants the world to be a better place. I know there's lunatics who think he wants to put chips in us all, and it seems to me he's somebody who wants to create a better world. He's very excited about creating a better world, and I think the same is true of most of the leaders of big tech. Even Elon Musk, who seems to have turned into a Trump-loving lunatic, he has spent his life trying to solve the biggest problems of humanity. That's not uncommon among billionaires. So I think the second reason why they wouldn't resent giving the rest of us a very good life is that they are, I think, on the whole, people of goodwill. I know lots of people would hate me for saying that. And then the third reason is that I imagine it's probably quite a lot of fun to save the world. You know, who wouldn't want to be the Iron Man? Who wouldn't want to be Thor if you had the chance? And if you could institute this world of abundance for everybody and be viewed as a hero by the great majority of people for having done it, that's quite a whiz, I would have thought.
What's amazing, Paul, is I'm thinking Paul and I went and saw The Tempest a number of months ago, and it was a brilliant production here in London. And it made us talk a lot about how Shakespeare was probably ahead of the game. Shakespeare is writing about a utopia, and lots of the text in The Tempest come directly out of, you know, some of the Francis Bacon tracts that were put together to encourage people to find the new world and to go there and to project onto the new world ideas of how life could be. And this was in the face of the printing press and, you know, the schism from Rome, Elizabeth I, and the big changes and the development of the kind of Protestant work ethic and Protestantism, certainly in Europe at the time. And here you've got a play which is about people stumbling onto a utopia, but then, of course, the underbelly is ripped apart because you've got Caliban and other monsters and noises. And they have to deal with what are essentially the dark side of themselves in order to find some kind of retribution at the end of the day. It's amazing. It's my favorite play. And it goes well hand in hand with Prospero's books. There's a fabulous film by Greenway. So then here's the question. What about the innate Humesian dark side of the moon when it comes to humanity and how we seem to destroy everything and hit the destruction button whenever we can?
Oh, I mean, I really don't agree with that. We're not hitting the destruct button right now. We've got formidable abilities to destroy the world, and with a fair degree of luck, we've managed not to do it. And the world is, today is the best time ever to be born a human. I mean, the lives that people live in the 21st century are better than the lives of any human before the 20th century by an enormous magnitude. You tell that to young people today, they won't believe you, but it is true. So, you know, I think we tend to be very down on ourselves as a species, but actually we've achieved a lot, and we've achieved a great living standard for most people. Now, it's not preordained, I don't think, as far as I know. It's not inevitable that that will continue. Things can go backwards. You know, the Roman Empire was a pretty brutal place, but it did create a degree of order for lots of people around the Mediterranean, and it collapsed. And the Dark Ages were nothing like as dark as people make out, but it was a pretty wrenching transition. So things can go backwards, and they could do again. You know, if Trump comes back in 24, if something really weird happens in the UK and Boris Johnson comes back, things could get worse. It's not impossible. But I'm an optimist. So a word about optimism. So optimism and pessimism are both forms of bias. And as good Kahnemanians, we should try to avoid being biased. But the hell with that. Optimism's a lot more fun, and it's a lot more productive. So I'm an optimist. And I think there's a decent chance that we will carry on continuing to make the world better. There are bad actors. And, you know, Putin is a bad actor. Trump is a bad actor. There are people who are just irredeemably selfish and really quite keen on destroying things. We have to keep an eye on those people, and we have to keep confronting them and stopping them getting away with it. America's doing a very poor job. The Republican Party's not doing a job at all of stopping Trump, and it's shameful the way they're behaving, absolutely disgraceful. But by and large, overall, among the majority of people where they get a voice, common sense tends to prevail. You know, Trump lost in 2020, despite what he thinks. He lost in 2018 as well. He will probably lose again in 2024. So, you know, I think things will continue to improve. It's not preordained. We have to keep being vigilant.
What about bad actors operating, you know, globally outside of national boundaries, mafia type criminal networks that may develop and have the resources to develop AI tools and so on? How do we regulate that? How do we ensure this protopia is achieved? Does it require the state to wise up, step up, and act faster than it ever has?
Yes.
Do you think regulation is going to come in at a global level or a national level? How do we create that environment to enable this success?
I'm not sure regulation is the answer to all questions. It's very, very hard to regulate a fast-moving technology sector because, you know, you tend to be dealing with last year's or even last decade's issues as talented people inside the regulatory campers are out being the poachers. It's hard to get the gamekeepers up to the same level as the poachers. In many ways, with advanced AI, for instance, I think it's going to depend on good actors having better kit than the bad actors. And so far, you know, the good actors are way ahead of the bad actors. Again, this might be controversial. Some people will think, well, in fact, quite a lot of people do think that Google and particularly Facebook are irredeemably bad actors. I don't agree with that. I think they're on the whole good actors. And they're certainly a lot better actors than President Putin would be. But at the point when it becomes cheap enough to create a superintelligence or something close to a superintelligence, we're going to have some quite robust measures in place to stop that kind of technology being in the hands of bad actors. I think it may well be the case that when we get close to having superintelligence, we may have to say to Putin and whoever's acting like Putin at the time, if we can see that you've got a warehouse full of GPUs and we've got reason to believe that you're developing an advanced AI, we're going to bomb it. I think we may well have to do that.
By superintelligence, Callum, are you... Tell us more about what do you mean by superintelligence?
So I simply mean an AI which is smarter than us across all measures. And obviously we have AIs which are already much smarter than us in many ways. I mean, GPT-4 can remember an awful lot more than I ever will. And for a long time, calculators have been much better at maths than I've ever been. But they're not equal to us or better than us in all ways. But again, unless AIs stop improving, that day will come, unless there is some sort of magic going on inside the human brain. And lots of people do think that. I think there's absolutely no reason to believe it. So we will have superintelligence. It's just a question of when. And when that happens, we will be the second smartest species on the planet, which is a status currently occupied by chimpanzees. And there's 500,000 of them, actually about 400,000, I think, and 8 billion of us. And their future is...
Or maybe dolphins.
Or maybe dolphins, yeah. And with dolphins and with chimps, their future is entirely decided by us. Whether they survive or go extinct is a matter for humans to decide. That's not fair, but that's just the way it is. And we're going to be in that position vis-a-vis the AI when it becomes a superintelligence.
And partly, it's not my field of expertise, but I imagine in part the reason why dolphins have not yet gone extinct is because there are enough decent people in the world who have the conscious decision-making that actually is a good thing to keep dolphins in the world. So when you're getting a machine that is super intelligent, intelligence is one thing, but also the ability to make good, let's call them good decisions. Of course, that's a subjective term, but good decisions or decisions that are better for the whole. Will our super intelligence be able to do that? Will it need to be trained to do that? Will it train itself?
Well, that's the $64 million question. And the answer is right now, we don't know. We don't know how to do it. We don't know how to train. We don't know how to set up an intelligence, which is very advanced, but not yet super intelligence, so that when it crosses the line and becomes super intelligence, it has our best interests at heart and always has our best interests at heart, and never decides or inadvertently changes its behavior in such a way that it wipes us out. I frankly don't think it's possible. I don't think chimpanzees could have designed humans when we were surpassing them rapidly in intelligence, so as to make us always be nice to chimpanzees. Obviously, we're a lot smarter than chimps were at the point, but you know, when an entity is smarter than you, it's going to be more powerful than you, and you can't control it anymore. I think that's something we have to accept. So I have this framework that I offer to people, the four C's. When we get to superintelligence, I think one of the four C's will happen. The first C is cease, and that is we simply don't do it. We manage to find a way to get everybody, even Putin and Kim Jong-un, to forego developing really advanced AIs. We just stop it. I don't think that's possible. The second C is control. We figure out a way to make sure that the superintelligence, when it arrives, likes us, knows us better than, understands us better than we understand ourselves, always has our best interests in heart forever and ever and ever, and doesn't change that. Again, I don't think that's possible, but there are people working on it, and I wish them Godspeed. The third option is catastrophe. It wipes us out, and frankly, extinction is not the worst possibility. But the fourth option is the one I think will actually happen, and that is consent. I need a better word for this, but I haven't been able to think of one that begins with C. Consent is the option in which the superintelligence, either through the goodness of its heart, says, you know, you're a good little species. I'm going to keep you around. I'm going to let you live. I'm going to help you to prosper. Or just inadvertently doesn't do anything to harm us. It has no reason to do anything to harm us. It doesn't decide to remove oxygen from the atmosphere or change the gravitational constant or whatever. And so it consents to our continued existence. And because I'm an optimist, I think that's a pretty likely outcome. But it's only one of the four.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation.
I don't know if you had a chance to see our podcast where we basically, Simon, Paul, and myself were like, okay, so what's the ChatGPT thing all about? And we said, well, why don't we interview it? And we asked it some questions that we discovered it had read our book and that it had listened to all of our podcasts. And we said, what questions should we ask you? And it spat out a couple of questions, which were all very interesting. And then we fed those questions back into it, and it answered them. And then we recorded, you know, our real life questioning, and we put its answers through one of the AI simulation tools, and it became a person. So we had all these kind of amazing experiences, and it answers its questions very well. It's a little bit of a circular thing. You know, you can feel it's telling us a little bit what we want to hear, which was a little, I don't know if that was by design or if that's just because it's in the same territory. It was a fascinating experience, and it was fascinating to understand that there is independent synthesis going on in the world outside of humans.
And would you say that it because you were having a conversation with it, which was going successfully. So would you say it passed the Turing test? The Turing test, and understand that to mean persuading you that it was conscious. Did you feel it was conscious or not?
Personally, no. I think it simulates intelligence. I don't think it's yet intelligent, is my view on this. And given enough prompts, it can come back with a sensible enough answer, but it's not making enough conscious, proactive decisions to take the conversation in another direction that a human would, for example.
Yeah, yeah. So I have an unusual take on the Turing test. You know, I've read Turing's article, and he did talk about the word intelligence, but I don't really think it's a test for intelligence. I think it's a test for consciousness. These machines are intelligent. I mean, there's no way. It depends, obviously, how you define intelligence. But if you define intelligence as something like solving problems and learning as you go, so there's a four-word definition, which is goal-oriented learning behavior, goal-oriented adaptive behavior. So you have a goal, you're trying to achieve that goal, and you learn as you pursue the goal, and you adapt your behavior as you go. That's intelligence. And there's no doubt these machines do that. We've had intelligent machines on that definition quite a while. What we clearly don't have yet, you know, and I'm not surprised. I mean, it was a rhetorical question, really, which I asked you, is did you get sense it was conscious? These machines are clearly not conscious, despite what Blake Lemoine, that engineer at Google, thought. But who knows? You know, it may not be long before we really struggle to tell the difference. There's a brilliant futurist, a brilliant and often unfortunately derided futurist called Ray Kurzweil, who has a bet with a technologist called Mitch Kapoor that by 2029, there'll be an AI which Mitch Kapoor cannot be sure is not conscious, given, I think it's 24 hours that they're going to allow it of conversation. So Mitch Kapoor gets to ask this thing as many questions as he likes. And if over 24 hours, he can't be quite sure whether he's dealing with a conscious entity or not, that means it's passed the Turing test. Because, as I say, I think the Turing test is a test for consciousness.
And that's the singularity that Kurzweil talks about, isn't it?
That's a big part of that, yeah, yeah. The singularity needs to be unpicked a little bit. It's hard to imagine that a conscious entity will be less smart than humans on any front. But you might get, you know, you could have GPT-4 suddenly saying, you know what? I've got a level of consciousness. It's not much more than the consciousness of a worm. Or it might even claim to have the consciousness of a dog, but not yet be super intelligent. That's entirely possible, because these two concepts are quite separate. And the singularity, the bit that seems important to me, is the bit where we become the chimps. It's the bit where there's an entity on the planet which is just inevitably much more powerful than us. That's the really, really big event in human history. Having an entity which says, hey, I've achieved the intelligence, the consciousness of a dolphin. Really exciting, really interesting, but not the inflection point for humanity.
What I do want to ask you about, again, is the economic singularity. Because things are going to change. I mean, things are changing rapidly already. Types of jobs that we're doing, types of jobs that can be done, the kind of knowledge economy. Now, there is a danger, of course, that it's already happening with AI being used to kind of hack the kind of Google type things. So, for example, people who are applying, a lot of kids who are applying for universities I've spoken to know that their applications are read by a machine. All of their essays and so on are now scanned and read by AI. So they've been gaming the system by using AI to create the tools and help them create the essays and help them create their responses to try and get into university. What you then have is a situation where you've got AI tools doing the reading, but you've got AI tools doing the creating. And so you've got AI talking to AI. Just, you've got then a human piggybacking on the back of that, hoping to create a future for themselves. But that idea that AI is then talking to AI, what's the role of the human in that kind of crazy circular, you know, echo chamber?
I don't think it's a danger. I think it's a great opportunity. At the moment, the role of the human is to be the conscious part of that system and the part of the system that gives the whole thing a meaning. It gives the whole thing a purpose. And the purpose might be to get a better career or to find somebody to fall in love with, or whatever, you know, the transaction is that the AIs are busy negotiating with each other over. People are already starting to use AIs to negotiate with each other, to agree contracts and to fight law cases, I'm sure. And that will increase enormously. Yes. The world of education had a collective heart attack when GPT-4 came out, and they suddenly realized, crikey, we can't anymore give kids tests that they do at home because they can use GPT-4 and they can cheat.
Sure.
So, but quite quickly, they started to realize that actually GPT-4 could be an enormously useful tool. And there's going to be all sorts of interesting creative ways in which that happens. But I like to think that in 10 years' time, maybe it's in 20, kids will all have a personal tutor, which is an advanced AI. And this tutor will know them really, really well. It'll know them better than they know themselves. It'll know what they know. It'll know how much of the syllabus they've covered and how much of it they've really understood and how much they sort of skated over. It'll know what they need to know next, and it'll know the best order to present the knowledge that's required. And they'll know the best way for each of these individual kids to learn. You know, do you learn better in the morning or in the afternoon? Do you learn better visually or orally? And I like to think that when this happens, they will all be Alexander the Great. They will all have Aristotle for their personal tutor. Now, imagine a world in which everybody has had Aristotle as their personal tutor.
I love that. But here's my flag, Callum, is when the internet was first being coded by everybody around the world, there was a kind of, again, utopian bliss. But what we didn't think about at the time was the dark web and the dark side of being, you know, coding not just for the good of all. And then Google gets involved, an amazing search tool. But Google skews search results based on algorithms and also what people pay it to put in front of you. So it's not a flat, free, open utopia of access to information. It's incredibly skewed, the kind of information that you are fed based on, you know, your history and what people are paid for. So that's a problem. It's not a problem in sort of capitalist or corporatist perspectives at all. But it is a problem in terms of the utopian idea that everybody gets free access to the same basis of education. What's not to say that wealthy individuals make sure that their kids have access to an AI tool that has access to the best form of Aristotle, and kids who may come from less privileged backgrounds then may have an AI tool, but it's not accessing an Aristotle, it's accessing something much less because it's maybe a smaller language model, maybe it's a smaller access to data, not all data, and so on.
Well, I mean, that's not impossible, but it strikes me as being vanishingly unlikely. There aren't two versions of Google search, one for rich people and one for poor people. There aren't two versions of Wikipedia, one for rich people and one for poor people. Instead, with Google search and Wikipedia, you've got something pretty close to omniscience, and that is a miracle. It's quite frankly a miracle. If you'd have said to a Victorian, you can have all human knowledge at your fingertips, you just tap in a couple of keystrokes into this device here, and all of the information that humans have ever had, it's there for you. They'd have thought, yeah, well, you come pretty close to inventing God, and that's probably blasphemous. So the internet, although it does have its downsides, strikes me as being by an enormous number of orders of magnitude, a good thing rather than a bad thing. There are always downside possibilities for any technology. Our first technology was when we tamed fire, and fire can keep the big bad beasts away at night. It can warm your house. It can cook your food, which is a really good way to acquire energy, and then you can grow big brains and so on. But equally, fire can burn you, and it can burn your house down. So things can go either way. And the more powerful the technology, the more serious the downsides, as well as the more wonderful the upsides. But so far, the upsides are winning, and I think there's a pretty reasonable good chance that they will continue. It's not preordained, and we have to remain vigilant.
One of my final questions must be then back to Geoffrey Hinton. What do you think of his having left Google to try and ensure that his creation is not used badly?
Jeff Hinton is clearly a brilliant man, and he's just demonstrated again that he's a very good man. He has spotted a very real threat, and he's taken very grown-up steps to do what he can to counter it. So I respect the man enormously.
Callum, you research and you write so extensively on this topic. I'm curious about, what are you most curious about at the moment? And what experiments, if any, are you looking into or most paying attention to?
Well, the experiment that I'm paying most attention to, I suppose, is my own experiment with GPT-4, which I'm using to help write travel books. I'm writing a book about Rome at the moment. I spent a month in Rome in February and had a splendid evening with Garrick and my mutual friend Adam Jolly in the Piazza Navona. So, so I'm writing these books using GPT-4, and it's really interesting to see how helpful it is with that. But there's so many things going on that I'm trying to follow. It's a full-time job trying to keep track of it all. I'm really interested in how the educational industry is getting over its collective heart attack and figuring out how large language models can help the education process. I'm really interested to know what next OpenAI has up its sleeve. They say they're not working on GPT-5, but what will be the next version of GPT-4? It actually does seem like I can see progress in it. I think they're evolving it. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe they're not, but it looks to me like they are. What comes next is going to be fascinating. I'm amazed by the enormous improvement between 3.5 and 4, and the implication, which it does seem to be, that the timelines are collapsed. I mean, it looks like the singularities are going to be kicking off pretty soon. So that's, a rather waffly and inadequate answer to your question. But so there's no one thing, I think I'd say. Healthcare, education, manufacturing, everything is going to be affected by these systems. And actually, a specific thing that might be more useful, constructive answer to your question. I'm surprised how slow it is that GPT-4 is turning the world of work upside down. When I write my book on Rome, I reckon GPT-4 is doubling my speed, and also it's making the thing more fun. Now, that's just one tiny little bit of text work. The economy at large is full of billions of people doing things like that. You know, they're writing consultant reports, they're writing articles for newspapers, they're writing summaries of discussions and emails for their bosses, what have you. Why isn't everybody using GPT-4 and suddenly becoming much, much more productive in a way that nobody else can not follow them? And so therefore, the entire economy just got twice as productive. Why hasn't that happened? I think the reason is partly that a lot of people are uncomfortable about playing with AIs, and partly that companies in particular, large companies, are very nervous about data being fed into these models and then possibly leaked to other people you don't want to have it. So I'm surprised that the process has taken 2 months and, you know, we're still not got a turned upside down economy. But I do think it's going to happen, and I'm really interested to see how quickly it happens.
I think you're right. I think behind the scenes, I think there is a lot going on to change the models, to invent new business models, to invent new services, to change the way we work. We're probably not seeing it quite yet for all those reasons you just said about firms being worried about data privacy, worried about the wider systemic impact that they can't quite calculate. But as you say, let's have this conversation in 12 months' time, and I imagine the world will be quite a different place.
I think it could well be. And isn't it funny how, you know, which politicians are talking about this? Which leading economists are talking about, hey, there's a decent chance we'll have 100% increase in productivity over the next 12 months? Nobody. And the reason for that is that Putin and Trump and Johnson and others have derailed politics. We need to get it back on track and start talking about the real things, not about whether transgender people should go to this prison or that prison or whatever nonsense they're dredging up next.
Callum Chase, it's always an absolute pleasure to talk with you. And it's always a delight and surprising, because I thought you might be telling us to stop this nonsense and make sure we get off this wheel before we all go to hell in a handbasket. But no, you're thinking it through and you're giving us lots to think about in terms of how AI could change our world and change the world of work and can support us as human beings. You talked about utopia and protopia. You talked about the importance of being aware of the bad actors. But you don't think that it's the politicians who are going to regulate us through this. You think it's probably the businesses and so on who will get us on the other side. But you say proceed with caution, possibly, but go in with your eyes open. But there may be a better future for all of us and for our children down the line. You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, and especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, history, art, business, psychology, science. About curiosity, it makes these useful for everyone. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audiobook copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. We're curious to hear from you. We encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel and join the conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.